Fusion, the international science radio show.
We have a bouncer and the doors of perception.
The good, the bad, the ugly.
It gets pretty exciting.
The myths, the truths.
Toxicology.
Astro-seismology.
Magnetism. The dark side.
Genetically engineered potatoes.
Planetoid.
Planetoid.
I love that word.
Hello and welcome to Diffusion. Sit back and relax while we transmogrify your brain with weird and wonderful science. I'm Ian Wolfe. On this special International Women's Day edition, Yolanda Stengers talks about emerging technologies and gender equity. But first up, news about soap. Soap, the virus killer. Professor Pauli Thordarson of the School of Chemistry at the University of New South Wales has tweeted a fantastic summary of why soap is your best defence against picking up COVID-19. Basically, viruses are held together with fat and stick to the fat on your skin. Soap dissolves the fat, allowing us to rinse away the virus particles and breaks them apart as they're rinsed away. Alcohol-based hand sanitizer and wipes also break the viruses apart, but not as effectively as soap. Here's a summary of his tweets. When you cough or sneeze, tiny droplets from your lungs and the mucous membranes around them can fly up to 10 metres. The larger droplets are thought to be the main coronavirus carriers, and they can go up to 2 metres. These tiny droplets end on surfaces and often dry quickly, but the viruses are still active when they're dry. When you touch a contaminated surface, the fat in the virus sticks more easily to the fat on your skin than almost anything else. Most people touch their face once every 2 to 5 minutes. When the virus sticks to the skin of your fingers and you touch your face, the virus is getting closer to being able to infect the mucous membranes of your eyes, mouth, and nose to travel down your throat to reach your lungs. If you can wash it away and dissolve it with soap and water, then not only does it not infect you, but it doesn't make anyone else sick either. Plain water only competes with the strong glue-like interactions between the skin and the virus through hydrogen bonds. Soap contains fat-like substances known as amphiphiles, similar to the fats in the virus membrane. The soap dissolves the glue that holds the virus together. Soon the viruses get detached and fall apart like a house of cards due to the combined action of the soap and water. Skin is quite rough and wrinkly, which is why you need a fair amount of rubbing and soaking to make sure the soap reaches every nook and cranny on the skin surface that could be hiding active viruses. With alcohol-based hand sanitizers, you need a high concentration of alcohol to get the virus to dissolve quickly. Vodka or whiskey will not dissolve the virus as quickly as hand sanitizer. Alcohol just doesn't work as well as soap at this task. Water's not very effective alone in washing away viruses, and alcohol-based products work better, but nothing beats soap. The virus detaches from the skin and falls apart easily in soapy water. Soap is the virus killer. You're listening to Ian Wolfe on Diffusion Science Radio. Send emails to science@diffusionradio.com. We're brought to you across Australia on the Community Radio Network and podcast over the internet on www.diffusionradio.com. Yolanda Stengers is an Associate Professor of Digital Technology and Society in the Emerging Technologies Research Lab at Monash University. She's a digital sociologist and human-computer interaction scholar, investigating the sustainability and gender effects of digital, emerging, and smart technologies. I spoke with Yolanda over Skype, so there's a few glitches. I began by asking her, is technology gendered?
Yes, absolutely. It's been gendered for a long time, really forever, actually. If you think going right back to sort of everyday household objects. We used to have black goods or brown goods and white goods, which were meant to appeal to either men or women. That's an early example, but certainly it's been gendered for some time and is continuing to be gendered.
Does that include all the upcoming shiny emerging technologies?
Absolutely. So we often think of advanced technology as being progressive on everything, including gender. But one of the concerns that's raised in our research in the Emerging Technologies Research Lab is that it's actually some advanced technologies are actually taking us backwards on gender equity and exacerbating stereotypes about, you know, what is a man or what is a woman, and really kind of entrenching those binaries as well without considering the full spectrum of gender that we have in society.
So in what kind of ways does it stereotype people?
Well, for an obvious example is digital voice assistants, which typically have a female voice, but also a very sort of subservient 1950s housewife sort of personality. So that's kind of, I guess, the obvious entry point. And there's a reason that technology companies do that. It's because we actually are more likely to accept and like technologies that come with stereotypes that we're familiar with. So if we have a device in our home that's performing sort of housekeeping duties, we tend to associate those with the stereotype of a woman in the home. But the problem comes when we then have those devices in homes en masse, as we do with something like digital voice assistants, and we therefore exacerbate those stereotypes of, you know, the woman's places in the home. So it's kind of like this reinforcing cycle that becomes or can become quite problematic when we start with the stereotype because people like the stereotype and they're familiar with it, so they'll like the device, and then we end up actually reinforcing that in society.
So I know people can technically change the voice of their digital assistant, but is that an appropriate solution to the problem?
It's one solution. It's a fairly basic solution. One of the issues with these devices is they still perform largely feminized sort of tasks, so administrative and housekeeping duties, as I said before. And it's not just their voice, it's also their sort of eagerness to help, eagerness to assist, the sort of subservient, I guess, programming that's embedded within them, which is often interpreted as being feminine as well. So in terms of what we need to do with these devices, we have to go beyond just looking at the voice and actually looking at their whole personality and the ways in which they're coming into our lives to assist us. And the reason we need to look at that is because they're not just coming in as a new technology that kind of sits in the corner and is a technology. They're coming in as gendered devices, as devices that are looking, behaving, sounding like humans, and that's where those issues arise.
Does any of that come in with the new technology where they get the digital assistants to pretend to be a person in a phone call?
Yes, absolutely. It's not an area I've looked at closely. My research has mainly been focused on technologies in the home, but certainly those stereotypes can be perpetuated much more broadly than just the devices that we're seeing on our phones or in the digital assistants like Google Home and Amazon Alexa. And there are other ways that these stereotypes get perpetuated as well. For example, there's a number of algorithms now that are kind of trying to assist companies to recruit people to jobs or trying to produce content en masse for newspapers or other sorts of areas. And one of the concerns with those kinds of devices is they, again, have sort of focused on either men or women with fairly sort of stereotypical attributes in terms of how they categorise different people, how they prioritise different people for a job, for example. So there was this classic case a while ago you may have heard of with Amazon, which came under fire because its algorithms were biased towards hiring men rather than women. And that was very much a product of the types of programming decisions that get made and also the ways that gender is even coded and thought about in those algorithms.
Isn't that a general problem that a lot of the artificial intelligence is really based on statistics of what people used to do, and what people used to do was biased?
Absolutely, yes. And I think one of the problems with algorithms and any form of programming is it has to simplify complexity. It has to, you know, assign things into categories, which is why the obvious choice is to just assign people to the category of man or woman. And unfortunately, that then, you know, reinforces these atypical ideas of what a man or woman is.
And what about speech recognition? Does that recognise women as easily as men?
So there has been some research that shows that female voice speaking to an assistant is harder for that assistant to understand, but also not just gender coming in there, but also different accents. So culturally diverse people may be having some more difficulties speaking to devices, and also people of different generations may be having difficulty in speaking to those voice assistants. And that's partly based on who trains these assistants to understand people. And so another criticism of, I guess, the broader tech industry is that because it has been an area that's largely dominated by men, and because, you know, they have been primarily involved in designing these devices, there has been a bias towards them, these devices sort of responding to the male voice and understanding the male voice. So yes, that is a concern as well.
So we've talked about how voice recognition can make it harder for women and anybody that doesn't sound like a typical man to interact with machines, and how some of the algorithms can stop women being hired. What other things are happening?
Well, I think one of the key concerns that I have with the industry at the moment is that when you go to the sort of frontiers of technology development, we find even fewer women than we do in the general IT or computing science industries, which, you know, generally don't have great representation of women either. But I guess the more advanced you go in the technology, the less diversity you find. And that's problematic, not only in terms of who's actually just kind of involved in making these things, but then in turn, what kinds of ideas sort of get taken up by technology developers? What kinds of things seem like a good idea? What kind of biases sort of creep into the design of technology? So I think that's another, you know, key concern that we need to be thinking about and ideally addressing it. It's really challenging because in those really technical disciplines, we do find that women are less interested in being involved.
And you alluded to the fact that people who are non-binary in their gender are treated differently as well. What's happening to them?
Well, they're largely invisible. I mean, one of the things that's happening, and I guess this is a product of the way that programming and algorithms sort of allocations work is, like I said before, there's this need to simplify, and simplification of gender involves just dividing people into men or women. So it's quite difficult to find examples of technologies that are bucking that trend, that are recognising a diversity of gender, that are providing different sort of personalities in technology that don't just kind of perform the typical feminine or masculine stereotypes that voice assistants typically do. So there's an invisibility of other genders and of diversity of gender in the types of technologies and the types of algorithms that we're seeing.
And then, of course, you've got the way that people are portrayed. I'm thinking of things like emojis and virtual reality avatars and computer games and things like that. They seem very strictly gendered.
That's true. That's not an area I've looked into in detail myself. But there, yeah, I mean, the emoji world, I think, went through a bit of a small revolution a few years ago with male and female emojis being offered. But again, in a fairly kind of binary form, depending on how you interpret gender when you look at emojis, I guess. But I guess the theme reigns true across all different types of technology, that we tend to sort of prioritise stereotypes because that's what people say they want. It's not that technology companies are kind of out of touch here. One of the issues actually comes from user studies, because user studies typically focus on what people want, what people like, what people are familiar with, what they'll accept. And unfortunately, people like and want and accept gender stereotypes. But as I said before, that doesn't really consider the broader implications of having those stereotypes reinforced through a device. And that's where I think we're kind of missing the mark in thinking about the broader implications for society of having these stereotypes reproduced en masse through technology.
And then, for some reason, every few years you get headlines about sex robots and all that kind of thing. And none of them, well, it seems like a very strange relationship that they're emulating.
That's right. So sex robots really perpetuate and exaggerate gender stereotypes of women, particularly from the pornography industry, and they're very much modelled on the types of ideals that come from the pornography industry. And again, really exaggerate the idea of a woman who is available constantly for sexual services, essentially. So they are a even more exaggerated form of a stereotype, if you like. There are a couple of examples of male sex robots that exist that also very much objectify the male body and prioritise penetrative sex, which is what the female sex robots do. But the market at the moment, even though it is a very niche market, is mainly focused on female sex robots, and the market is targeted towards a male audience or male market.
It's funny because you would think that you could make technology that was just human rather than aimed at some idea of male or female market. Is this marketing, or is it just people have trouble thinking differently?
Well, I think if you're going to make a female sex robot that's modelled on the pornography industry, obviously it's going to be of more interest to men than women. Women in general are less interested in pornography, and there's a number of studies and reasons for that, or at least the pornography that's traditionally portrayed. So it's unsurprising then that they're going to be of less, less interested in the kinds of sex robots that are currently being offered on the market. But it doesn't mean that women couldn't be interested in and aren't interested in new and diverse types of technology. In general, though, what's kind of consistent across the board is that when it comes to emerging or advanced technologies, again, that sort of plays to a masculine stereotype in terms of who's interested, who wants to use those devices. So typically in our research in smart homes, for example, we find that men are more interested in adopting and using those technologies than women. And that's really interesting too. That creates some interesting gender dynamics in the home environment, because if you have one group of people, so mainly men, who are bringing these devices into the home and using them, it creates some interesting gender dynamics. So one of the concerns at the moment is around the use of smart home devices in domestic violence situations. There's an emerging body of research around that. So this would be a partner, for example, locking someone in or out, or using monitoring technologies to surveil their partner and to monitor their movements without their knowledge or their consent. So these kinds of possibilities become more real when we have a gender imbalance in who's interested and using smart technologies as well.
Sounds appalling. I mean, it's bad enough with parents wanting to track their children all the time through their phones, without abusive partners trying to track people everywhere at every moment.
It's been a concern for some time with cyberstalking. There are a number of studies that have just emerging that suggest that the smart home could become, another site in which technologies can be used to coerce a partner or to enable domestic violence.
Is there any good news about gender equity and emerging technology?
Well, yes, there is good news, and there's pockets of really exciting research that's happening. Some of it's coming from feminist researchers and others from, people just who are concerned with some of these gender dynamics that are arising with smart home technology. Look, in the research we do, we find that many women are actually really excited by digital technologies. Everybody loves their smartphones, right? And of course, they're very beneficial to all genders. Digital voice assistants likewise provide many valuable benefits in the home environment. It's not to say that all these technologies are rubbish and we should just throw them out. And it's not to say that women aren't interested in them or all genders aren't interested in them. So I think I'm not trying to suggest that it's all doom and gloom here. There are a number of designers that are bucking the trend, I guess the stereotypical trend of how some of these devices are getting made and the kinds of stereotypes that perpetuate. There's a great example of a banking chatbot, actually, which was designed by someone called Jacqueline Feldman, and she created this bot called Kai. Kai is genderless, or gender ambiguous, I guess, and doesn't actually try to be human at all. It actually tries to embody what she calls a bot personality. So it really takes the conversation and the focus away from how do we design different gendered devices, and gives bots their own unique personality, their own unique kind of sense of being. I think that's a really interesting angle to sort of take this in a different direction. One of the distinguishing things about Kai is that Jacqueline Feldman sort of designed into this device is it's designed with the principles of dignity and respect. So it stands up for itself. It doesn't put up with crap. It really, it's designed to, if you're going to start abusing it, which is something that people do to digital devices, then it will shut down. It won't put up with that kind of behaviour. And I think that's a really interesting and positive development.
I think it is. And I like the idea that it's got its own identity, because as humans, we can project a personality onto anything. So it doesn't have to be a pretend human that we're talking to. We'll talk to our cats, we'll talk to pens, we'll talk to computers, we'll talk to anything. Why shouldn't it have its own identity?
Well, exactly. And as you say, technology will take on an identity. It will be anthropomorphized, whether we like it to be or not. But what we're seeing now is a suite of technologies that are deliberately anthropomorphized. They deliberately have personalities and genders and individuality designed into them. So there's an opportunity there to actually buck those stereotypes, to challenge what it is to design a device with personality. And there's some, I think, fascinating research going on in that area. One of the things I didn't say earlier with the problem with a overly feminized and subservient digital voice assistant is that there's, again, emerging evidence that people are abusing them. So they, you know, yell at them, or they might flirt with them or make sexual suggestions. And there's been a lot of critique about this in terms of how these devices respond to those remarks. The companies have really upped their game there and have made a number of changes to try and improve the way that these devices respond, but there's still a long way they could go. And what is interesting there is the effect of having a whole cohort of these feminized devices being abused in a feminized way. So the abuse is the kind of abuse that is targeted towards women in society generally. So it's of sexual nature, or it's of a gendered nature. And one of the concerns with that is that then reinforces the idea that we can make these kinds of sexual invitations or comments or abusive statements towards women, because the line between the device and the human is increasingly blurred. Not everybody, including particularly children, can make those can easily distinguish between abuse directed towards a feminized device and abuse directed towards a woman.
I think also if you're talking to your devices all day, every day, that becomes more of your normal communications, and it's going to be harder to switch when you're talking to real people.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and again, this is all an emerging area. This stuff's coming out so fast, and really, you know, the research community is doing an enormous amount of work in this area, but it is still very, very new. And so there are a number of different effects that we do need to be looking at and asking some pretty serious questions about. My colleague Jenny Kennedy from RMIT University and myself are putting out a book this year called The Smart Wife. It's coming out in September with MIT Press, and it does cover a lot of these themes. But one of the things, I guess the starting point for Jenny and I in that book, is that we have a wife drought in Australia, which is a term coined by Annabelle Crabb in her book, The Wife Drought. And these devices are kind of a natural, or at least an understandable response to this drought that we have of, you know, women increasingly going out into the workplace, but not a lot of corresponding help coming back into the home to, you know, do all the things that a traditional wife or a homemaker used to do. So with this gap in labour, there's still this kind of interest and even a fantasy for somebody, as you say, a slave or a wife replacement or an assistant that can come into the home and do many of these things that people are really struggling with now. It kind of explains a little bit about where some of these devices at least are coming from and what the appeal might be.
Well, people do talk about house cleaning robots that also tell jokes. And, you know, that could be the sort of equivalent of having a servant in your home who doesn't have their own life.
Well, yeah, I mean, there are a number of devices that are positioned that way, and they're not all feminized. Some people have robotic vacuum cleaners, and there's a mix of gender attributes that are assigned to those. But I guess the point is that they're still coming in to perform these kinds of traditionally feminized tasks around cleaning or, you know, assisting or whatever it might be. And there's a broader question too there, I guess, about whether that's what we should be striving towards as a society, and what might be lost if we assign, for example, some parenting responsibilities to a digital voice assistant as opposed to that coming from parents. So these are all emerging questions, because we haven't had these devices in our lives for that long, and their integration into our everyday routines is expanding pretty rapidly. So, yeah, it's more that we need to be asking questions about it, I think, rather than drawing any sure conclusions at this stage.
Well, Yolanda, thank you very much.
No problem. Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
That was Associate Professor Yolanda Stringers from Monash University talking about gender and emerging technologies. You can read more in her new book, The Smart Wife. And you can follow her on Twitter at Yolanda String. And that's all from us this week on Diffusion. Are you a scientist, artist, biohacker or maker who'd like to be interviewed about your work? Would your company like to sponsor Diffusion? Send your contributions, opinions, helpful suggestions and donations to science@diffusionradio.com. That's science@diffusionradio.com. Please like the Diffusion Science Radio page on Facebook and rate the show on iTunes. Tell your friends. Follow me on Twitter at Ian Wolfe. The news music was Rhinos Theme by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. I produce Diffusion, which is broadcast around Australia to 28 stations on the Community Radio Network, including 2RBM in the Blue Mountains of New South Wales, 8CCC in Alice Springs and Tennant Creek, 2MVR in Nambucca Valley, 3MBR in the Mallee Border districts of Victoria and South Australia, City Park Radio 7LTN in Launceston, Tasmania, and 2XXFM in Canberra. Diffusion is syndicated globally on the National Science Foundation's Science 360 internet radio station and also on astronomy.fm. Subscribe to the podcast on the Diffusion website, www.diffusionradio.com. That's www.diffusionradio.com, and check the website for links, photos and videos about this week's show. If you enjoyed the show, you can explore more than 1,000 previous episodes archived on diffusionradio.com, where the shows are labelled by keywords so you can focus in on the stories you want to hear. Join my patrons at patreon.com/diffusionradio. Make a donation through paypal.me/IanWolfe. Support Diffusion by buying from the affiliate links at diffusionradio.com/support. Subscribe to the Diffusion YouTube channel at youtube.com/c/diffusionradio. I'm Ian Wolfe. Join us inside your audio device of choice for more science wondering next week on Diffusion Science Radio.
Science is fun. It helps you to learn, to know, and to appreciate. When you study science, you may go on field trips. You discover the marvelous interrelationships between all living things. You learn to read the history of the Earth as it is written in rocks and fossils. You find out what makes things tick. Everything from a molecule to a living organism. In the study of science is found the most useful and satisfying knowledge of man. Knowledge of his physical world, its past, its present, and its future. And in your moments of relaxation, now and in the years to come, you will find the study of science leading you into fascinating pursuits. Photography. Collecting. Why study science? Study science because you will find in the study of science a richer, more rewarding life.